Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, hello, welcome. It is the MXP podcast. This week is the Machin podcast. I'm joined by my dad for this one. Dad, hi.
Hello.
You good?
No.
No, you're in a bad way, aren't you?
Yeah, full of gold. I just get my voice back after the weekend and I lose my voice again.
It's typical, isn't it? There's a lot of people walking around the streets of Liverpool, walking into offices today and yesterday and whatever, with a slight croak in the throat. Have you suitably recovered? Apart from the fact that you've come down with a cold after the fact, emotionally come down from the final?
No, I'm still way up there. Yeah, still just buzzing off the whole thing. It's, super.
It's one of those weird situations, because obviously we're recording this a few days now, midweek after the Champions League final, and I'm sure the people who watch this and listen to this who aren't Liverpool fans will probably have reached their saturation point of seeing happy Liverpool fans, but we're not. We're happy Liverpool fans. And I said this before the podcast last week about how, you know, we're not going to focus too heavy on Liverpool stuff on this channel, because we've got Redmen. I do a lot on my personal YouTube channel as well. But again, I think the Champions League has such a cultural significance. It has such a big place in football and in the world, and obviously in the city that we're from as well. And I thought it was worth talking about. But we're going to talk a little bit more about you in a bit, Dad, and your kind of life growing up through it all and what have you. But in the aftermath, what I've discovered is this is the best social media has ever been. My wife's been turning to me over the last few days and going, what are you doing? Because we've reached the point where I spend a lot of time on my phone because of my job, and we've reached the point where I've had to say to her at times, like, there are times where I am often working, I'm not often dicking about messing around on the internet. No, I have. I've spent the last 3 days, every time I refresh my Twitter feed, I see something else, something new, something brilliant that I'd not seen before.
A different angle on it, yeah. Yeah. I mean, all the footage, I'm still buzzing off the fan park.
Yeah.
And the footage that's still coming out from that, from different angles and people's different experiences of it, just brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's played a part in what's going on in my head.
Yeah.
In that I put a tweet out saying, has anybody else had just Liverpool songs run through there for 2 days? Well, it's now 4 days.
Yeah.
Well, and I just nothing but Liverpool songs.
Well, you said to me, because we were lucky enough to get backstage on the fan park, but you said to me on like the morning of it, like, I don't really know the words to the Firmino song yet, and I was like, you will. And that's the thing, is that it's, and again I said to you, because Kiev was so incredible, wait till you see this. What was your takeaway from the kind of build up from the fan park stuff?
Well, the fan park, it'd be a bit strange to say it made the occasion, because obviously we went on and won the European Cup for the sixth time, but it got me really in the right place, you know. I mean, normally you go to the match and you're there, you know, you're in the right place for watching Liverpool play, but I don't know, there's something about being with all your compatriots, you know, and just buzzing off the same thing, and you carry that. I'm fairly certain that if you walked up to anyone, any Liverpool supporter after the fan park, they'd all have that same look on their face,
yeah.
You know. It was just this feeling of belonging,
yeah.
You know.
We got a great moment, because we took a little break and went to get some lunch, didn't we? And we got chatting to two Aussie fellas who they'd flown over from Australia.
Yeah.
Just to be
without tickets,
just to be in Madrid and soak it all up. And I think we heard a lot of stories and tales around that. Obviously, loads of people who managed to get in, which was great. But yeah, you know, we had there's talk of it, there being 50,000 people turned up to that fan park, and I've heard rumours of more and what have you. But you know, there wasn't 50,000 Liverpool fans in the ground, and then we were bumping into people saying, "Where are you going?" And they were going to they found a bar by the Bernabeu, so yeah. And Liverpool fans just scattered throughout the city to find themselves little places to settle.
But people kept saying to me, because if you look at the footage from the front, you see this like Stonehenge-y sort of pie sign made of, you know, stone or whatever. And that's about as far as I could see.
Yeah.
But I kept getting people saying to me, it goes way, way back beyond that. Yeah. And then you see some of the footage that people had filmed, and you just...
From the other end, from like beyond that.
And you realise how immense it was.
Yeah. So what are some of the favourite things that you've stumbled upon in your many Twitter refreshes in the days that have followed?
I'm still gobsmacked by the parade the following day.
Yeah.
Because although, and I think what I really liked was that the players were duped.
Yeah.
They thought going to like Queen's Drive or Old Swan or whatever was the Liverpool fans cheering them home.
Yeah.
And then they got to town and they saw the Strand. And you just see the look on their faces when they see the amount of people who are lying in the Strand.
It was funny because when we got to Queen's Drive, and it was there was a lot of people lying in Queen's Drive because we got there a good hour pretty much before it all, the bus actually arrived. There was loads of people there, but it wasn't dense. And then I walked up to the Fiveways and there was loads of people, but it wasn't thick. By the time the bus came, you know, the roundabout, half of the roundabout was completely full of people, so you could only go around it one way. Yeah. It wasn't cordoned off by the police, it was blocked off by fans. And I was immensely proud of how many people that was. But you're right, when I started to see the footage and I watched the live stream of the parade, and you see, and now you see the photos, and they're going to be some of the most iconic photos in Liverpool's history, with all the smoke going off, and it's the wide shots when you see the volume of bodies.
Yeah, there's lots of aerial ones as well.
Mm.
You know, you just see the depth, and there's one I don't know exactly where it is, but the whole of the side is full of people, both sides full of people, but on the other side, it even goes back down the street. You know, it's just phenomenal the amount of people who got there.
It's when you realise that you're talking, it's 1,000 people deep off the side.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you're going down the side, so you are miles away from the road and the coach would have been a dot to a lot of those people, and they just wanted to be there and see it. One of the things that really got me in the immediate aftermath of the game was the Jordan Henderson video that came up with him hugging his dad. That was the closest I'd come to crumbling when I first saw that, because it's quite a long video, because it's quite a long hug.
Yeah, well, what I didn't do, the first thing I saw was Jordan hugging Klopp and crying.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, he's just overcome with the emotion of being captain and winning the trophy. I hadn't realised the backstory until much later. And yeah, it was a really heartwarming story, wasn't it? You know?
And you realise his dad had come back from his throat cancer. He'd been his greatest, you know, his greatest supporter throughout all this time, and to have him there as well. And then he gets the moment. It's not like a, because we all do it. We all do the masculine thing. We can have a hug. But you don't often have a full-on collapse into each other hug, and you see it, and it's one of those moments of a between a normal hug and a proper hug is when someone just grips a little tighter halfway through, and you can see that. And like, I think Jordan maybe he just collapses a bit, and his dad grabs him a bit more and gives him a little pat on the back, and they stay in that for ages, and they're both obviously really emotional. And you're right, we had much more of that this time around, I think, than like Istanbul and what have you, and I think it gives you a great sense. I feel a much greater connection to this Liverpool team than I think I did even to the 2005 one, because you had Gerrard and Carragher and we loved it for them, and there's a lot of them kissing the medals and kissing the things and celebrating, and we've got all that. But the I feel like the connection between the fans and the players, because we see the videos of like Trent celebrating and the players celebrating in front of the fans.
The big difference for me is that 2005, we knew that team wasn't very good.
Yeah.
we sort of stumbled our way to the final and then won it in the most brilliant, dramatic fashion. And that's why it's so iconic, is because it was so dramatic.
Yeah.
And the comeback, the whole world were thrilled by what we were able to do.
Yeah.
But this time, We're winning it with a team who are only just starting.
Yeah,
this team is not going to change next year. Mm-hmm. Like after 2005, the team was totally different in 2006.
Yeah,
this it feels as though it's the start of us being a great side, not just a great club.
Yeah, absolutely. You know. One of the things I thought was really encouraging about being over in Madrid as well, because there's been this. Social media, I think, conceit that Liverpool fans are all knobheads this year, and then there's everyone hates Liverpool and doing it for the rest of the world and not have Liverpool win and what have you. And I've spoken to Flav, who's a Spurs fan mate of mine, and he was saying the positive way coming back from Spurs fans is they went with an expectation of how Liverpool fans were going to be, and the positivity that they've come back with. We saw it a few times. We saw on a couple of different occasions Liverpool fans and Spurs fans inhabiting the same bar, having a little sing back and forth. I never saw an ounce of trouble.
No. And the number of tweets I've seen from Tottenham supporters who've gone out of their way to say, I was really impressed with how Liverpool fans conducted themselves and we had a great time and blah, blah, blah. And the Tottenham fans have been absolutely brilliant in defeat.
Yeah.
Absolutely spot on.
Yeah.
I'm very, very impressed with them.
Because the thing is, and I must admit, I was worried. Whenever I hear it being two English teams in the final, I am worried because... look, as Liverpool fans, we've had to live in the shadow of Ev Heysel, haven't we? For all this time, and that idea of it being thuggish culture, and we saw it in the press coverage of this game ahead of the game when we landed in Madrid. It was all about this, almost like the English terror descending upon Madrid, and there was loads of video clips of loutest looking Spurs fans with the beers, and they showed the clip of the Liverpool fan pushing the fella into the fountain in Barcelona again, and all this kind of stuff. And it was a real... We ended up being, both Liverpool fans and Spurs fans, a big advocate for the way English football
moves on.
The thing
is, you can never legislate for having one dope.
Yeah.
We'll do something stupid, or two or three people will do something stupid, or you'll get rotten drunk and get fighting mad, as people do.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't reflect on the whole fan base.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I don't even recall one of those incidents in Madrid. I've not heard any reported or anything like that.
That's right. But I hopefully you've got to hope that it starts to finally puts to bed a lot of those fears and stuff, because they still exist on the continent, don't they? There is a stigma that's attached around English football fans.
Well,
still.
I mean, I think what's emerged in recent years is ultra right fans in other countries see us as a sort of notch on their club or whatever it is they use. They see us as the hooligans, to beat, even though we're no longer that people. We've given up hooliganism to a large extent.
You see with Italian football, you don't hear a story of an English team going to Italy without fans getting chased.
Well, they get stabbed in Italy. It's just disgraceful. But... I would never have gone to an England football match, even if I was inclined, which I've not never really been. I have seen England at Anfield, but I wouldn't have gone because it was full of mad nutters who just wanted to fight people.
Yeah.
And, I've heard reports, at Liverpool away games where there were groups of people who weren't Liverpool supporters who were going to Liverpool football matches abroad so they could have a fight.
Yeah.
We've moved away from that, but sadly, the far right are on the rise, and football's a real target for those people because it's easy.
Yeah.
What
was it? What was it like? You mentioned it there. What was it like those immediate the years in the aftermath of Heysel? Because again, it's the darkest mark against Liverpool Football Club and almost English football history. Really.
I don't know. I personally, I didn't think many of them were Liverpool fans. Not many of them were from Liverpool who caused the problems. I don't think enough blame was taken by UEFA for putting people in a stadium. I mean, every football supporters, all football supporters in those days had moments where they charged other fans. But you were segregated, so it didn't really matter. Yeah. But if you're in a ground which is crumbling, then it's a disaster waiting to happen. And, you know, UEFA have never stood up and taken any responsibility for what happened. And the year before, we'd been attacked by Rome fans and people got stabbed. You know, and I've said before, I knew someone who got stabbed and never went to a football match again after Rome. So we were playing another Italian side. So there was bound to be people there who wanted to have a bit of a go.
Yeah.
So why put them in a stadium which wasn't big enough, which was crumbling? Well, the friends I had who went came back with their tickets because they said there were no turnstiles. You just walk through a hole in the wall.
Yeah,
you know. It was just crazy. And no, I'm not trying to exonerate the fans that caused the problem. But there were other people who were culpable as well, and they've never stood up.
Yeah.
And so I personally never really felt massive guilt over it. I felt a bit of shame, you know, as you would. And I'd not buy in this thing that you get from a lot of Man United supporters and Everton supporters about Liverpool fans were responsible for them getting banned for 5 years. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
What got them banned for 5 years was all the hooliganism that came before Heysel, mainly by Man United supporters and Chelsea supporters and Tottenham supporters, not Liverpool supporters. Liverpool supporters had a fantastic record.
Yeah.
You know,
but it ended up being the straw that broke the camel's back.
It was the straw that broke the camel's back, and we got an extra year ban because of that. And, you know, that's fair enough. And you take that on the chin.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've never really recovered from that until now.
Yeah. That's right, isn't it? Because I think that, again, it's something you still see it now. You still see it referenced all the time. You know, fans of other clubs go back and reference it. And a lot of them, look, again, I was, a couple of years old at the time. I've got no sense of it, what it was like and what it meant at the time. But it did, you know, it cast a cloud over English football, that the whole thing hasn't, you know, is only really starting to emerge from in modern times.
Well, we still get called murderers when, you know, by idiots, you know.
But it led, it led on into Hillsborough. And, you know, I was six at the time, you know, and you actually went to Hillsborough, didn't you? I mean, we'll talk about the aftermath and stuff of it, but what was that like? Because, you know, that was a time when, you know, Liverpool were all, we're always in the FA Cup. The later stages of the FA Cup, you know, we'd won it in 86, we'd lost it in 88, and we were heading back towards the final again in 89. We'd been, people had been to Hillsborough in the times leading up to that. It was known amongst fans as not being a particularly great environment. You've told me this story in the past, but what was your experience going down to Hillsborough on that day?
Well, it was exactly the same as the year before, you know. Got in the car, drove down to Sheffield, found somewhere to park the car. In fact, we parked in the same place, I think. Then we did. We got a bus into town, as we don't had some lunch. Except in this case, we went into a pub the second year. This is Hillsborough year. Went in, and it was full of Nottingham Forest supporters. So we left pretty quickly, and we ended up getting a bus back towards the ground and getting off and stopping at a pub and having some, you know. Having a pint and something to eat, and then got to the ground, as we always did, exactly as we'd done the year before, with about half an hour to go before kickoff, and just rammed. You just couldn't get anywhere near the turnstiles. And I was with my 16-year-old, with a 16-year-old son of my friend, who was got off to go some other part of the ground. So I was fearful for the 16-year-old, and I dragged us out to the side by a wall, and I stood us by the wall, and I said, "We don't need to see the kickoff. You know, it's too dangerous." And then they opened the gates, and we strolled in, and it was we were in the stand at the side, so we walked down there, and we were fine, but then started seeing, you know, people on the pitch, and then eventually I saw someone carried down. I thought, "He's dead." You know, so I got up and I got the 16-year-old out. We were in separate seats from a different block. So I went and got him and took him out, made sure he didn't see any more of that.
Because it's one of those things, isn't it? Because you'd have seen it unfolding. And that's the thing, you know, there's people who are obviously in the Leppings Lane end at the time, you know, who were right in the crush and right in the thick of it. You know, and I guess one of those things, you must look back on it because it's a by the grace of God kind of situation, isn't it? Because
I've been in loads of crushes, particularly if you used to go to Anfield and you'd end up in, say, the Kemlin Road, in Kemlin Road itself.
Yeah.
Rammed with people trying to get in through the turnstiles, and it would just be absolutely horrendous, you know. And you'd always be, you know, you'd be told, oh, make sure you don't have your hands in your pockets because you'll end up breaking your arm and all, you know. So that was the environment. So you were quite used to crushes of football grounds.
Well, you look at the cop, and the cops are a swaying, full motion sort of thing in those days prior to the
And you used to queue to get in because you paid on the gate. That's one of the good things about today, that you don't have that kind of crushing to pay on the gate. But I do think football's lost a bit, that you can't just walk up to a game where you know you can get in, that's not going to be full, and you can't pay on the gate and go in and watch. I think that's a loss to the game, really. But you were cute. I mentioned this the other day to you, that when we were in cup competitions, you'd have to queue up to get a ticket, before the game. And the queues would go as far back and beyond Priory Road.
Yeah.
You know, just thousands and thousands of people queuing up, waiting for their chance to buy a ticket.
But you take us back to it then, because obviously you've got that situation. You've been in going to football. I mean, what would you count as your first season of going to the football?
Well, our first game was January 61, and that was, we were still in the second division. And we were promoted the next year. We in the closed season, I was reminded, almost every kid in our road got what was called yellow jaundice, which is a hepatitis, and we all ended up in Olive Mount Hospital. And my dad kept coming in, "We've just signed Ian St. John's. We've just signed Ronnie Edson." I was like, "Oh, good, great." The first game I went to, we lost in a cup to Sunderland. I remember that vividly. We lost 2-0, but you know, and we didn't get promoted that season. But the following season, it was just, you know, that was it. That was the start of Shankly's brilliance, that where he put together a team that would get not just promoted, but within two seasons win the title.
Yeah,
you know, brilliant.
So you talk about that, you know, by this point. By the time we get to this, but you've been watching Liverpool for the best part of 30 years by this point, I guess, then, you know, obviously slightly shy off. And you've been in those close quarters environments, you know, the way in which people got into football games and we're set up inside stadium in football games at the time, obviously completely different now, but it was like that then. What's that like then, you know, so you're there, you're watching the game kick off, and you must know from the start, because you can see how packed it is. You watch the footage back. You must have known very early on that it wasn't.
Well,
wasn't,
you know, by the time we got in and sat down, it was already, you know, starting to be a problem. You could see the police were at a bit more presence at that end, and it was a bit odd, really, because the game had already kicked off, but you knew there was something going on behind the goal, and so it was very distracting.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't tell you a thing about what the football was like in the first few minutes.
Yeah, and then you start to see, because the basically the game gets stopped, doesn't it? And then the police end up lining up on the halfway line because it's reported they wondered that they thought Liverpool fans were causing a problem.
What happened was that the Nottingham Forest fans, who had the great big cop end, they started shouting something or other, and the Liverpool fans, who were on the pitch by this point dragging people out and putting them on advertising boards and stuff like that, all really, you know, roared and rushed, you know, towards that end of the ground. They didn't get very far. They just wanted to make their anger known. Mm-hmm. And the response of the police to that was to bring on loads of police and just line the whole halfway line. So there was a barrier, basically. Which is, again, a total misreading of what was going on, you know, basically.
Yeah. And so what was it? Because this is where, like, my memory of it comes in, because I remember having it on, it would have been on Grandstand or whatever, on BBC at the time. And hearing what was happening and starting to see the footage, and all I knew that was that you were there. I had no way, we had no idea where you were within the ground and what have you. So, you know, you get out of the ground, it's what happens, because it's a different age now, where information's passed around, it's completely different. When did you walk out? You walked out just at very, very early on into the game.
Well, you couldn't get out. So I just basically brought Christian down, and we had a drink. You know, I'm going to say a drink. You know, we were 16, we had a coffee or whatever. And we just waited and waited and waited. And then about 20 to 5, we were quite near the Leppings Lane end, and we went up and sat in some of the empty seats there just to see what the hell was going on or whatever. And I always remember seeing a couple who sat in front of me in the main stand, and I saw them, and I was so relieved to see them. Yeah. I didn't really know them.
Yeah.
It was just that, you know, these are people who are alive.
Yeah.
That's what went through my head, you know. That was round about the time the game would have been ending, and pretty soon after that they opened the gates, and they may have been open already, but we were due to meet Christian's dad at a set place, you know, a set time after the end of the game. So that's when we went out. And I remember when we went out, there was a policeman, and I said to him, how many are dead? And he said, oh, we don't know anything about that, we've got no information whatsoever, which was untrue.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So you walk away from the ground then, and of course, you know, this is pre-mobile phone days and what have you. Because what were your steps then, kind of thing? Is it about to get to a phone, or is it about just trying to get away from the ground?
No, we got away from the ground, and we still didn't have any real clue about what had unfolded, and we didn't know numbers or anything like that. And we knew there were a few people dead, but I don't think we thought that it was as big as it was. And so we got back to the ground, got back to the car, and we drove for a while, and then we stopped at a service station and then phoned home.
Yeah. And because I remember, I was like only six, but these are the little moments that I remember. I remember that phone call coming through, and I remember that the palpable sense of relief of, well, you're all right.
I remember that I rang, and your mother answered the phone, and I said, you know, hello, and blah, blah, blah. And she said, is that Brian? That's the guy I was with. I said, no. She just, I don't know, she was obviously so wound up that she couldn't really focus on, because she obviously knew far more about what had gone on than we did.
You know?
So, very strange. And, of course, the next day, Sunday morning, we always played football, if you remember. We always used to go to Sefton Park and Sunday morning and play football. And we did that. But throughout the whole game, I didn't realise at the time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It was like post-traumatic stress that just felt like in another world. And then I obviously went into work as a social worker. We had responsibility then to start working with people.
So tell me about that, because obviously, as I say, you're a social worker at the time, working in the city. You walk into work Monday morning, you know, what's...
No, I went into work Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoon.
We had a big meeting in town to try and organise our response, basically. So, and that was a bit weird as well. Then I realised, again, still I was in this fog, you know. And I didn't really understand why.
Yeah.
Because obviously harm had come to me or anyone I knew. I'd got home and I'd listened on the radio all night to what, because obviously it was a major disaster and it was just full. The airways were all was full of everything. That was all anything was talking about, you know. So I suppose it all sort of came into me without me realizing, yeah. You know. So then I went into work Monday and we started working on referrals of people who were affected by.
Because obviously, we think of social workers a lot as being dealing with kids and stuff like that. But what was this? Who were you working with in this period?
They were survivors, basically, people who were traumatized. People work with the families. I went to one family of who'd lost their son, but most of the families were picked up in Sheffield by people and. And already on Saturday night, there were people involved on the ground. So basically what we dealt with was people who were traumatised by the actual experience of surviving the Lappings Lane end.
Because that was it. That is the big impact. People talk a lot about, like, obviously, the people who lost their lives and the immediate families and stuff. But you see this with the Hillsborough Justice Campaign. You have the Hillsborough Family Support Group, and obviously they were predominantly focused on the people who were directly impacted by that. But then you had the wider work, because this had a knock-on effect throughout the entire city, didn't it? Because it's, you know, you're talking about a city of 500,000 people, but and then by that, you know, 96 people is a fractional percentage of that.
Well, there's 96 people who died. There's hundreds who were injured. Then there are thousands who are in the Lappings Lane end who experienced the problem. Then there are people maybe who were in the Lappings Lane and who didn't experience it quite that way, who maybe a bit they're at the back or whatever, but would have been taken up. Then there were people in the stand up above who watched it unfold. Pulling people out. Then there were people like me who were in the ground and again watched it. Then there were all the relatives. I mean, I dealt with some people whose, you know, families were influenced by the trauma that their father or their husband had suffered, you know. And
you talk about like the post-traumatic stress thing, because that has a knock on, you know, people come back from war, don't they? And you don't come back the same person. A lot of these people, and so you talk about, I guess you're talking about somewhat, that has a knock-on effect in how a family interacts when someone comes back with that level of trauma and experience as well.
Yeah, I'm sure probably families split up over it. Yeah. Obviously, famously,
Trevor Hicks.
But I'm sure that he wasn't the only one, because those kind of tensions, you know, raise their head, don't they? I mean, I remember we had one who was a soldier, and he had real trouble.
Yeah.
At the time, even the army were not greatly up on post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
Strangely.
Well, yeah. What was it like then in those days and weeks to follow? Because we know, you know, how involved a lot of like the Liverpool people, Kenny Dalglish in particular, was, and there was the memorials at Anfield.
Kenny and Marina were absolutely brilliant. I remember I went along to the ground on the last day of the tributes, where, you know, half the ground was covered in flowers and stuff, and there was going to be a memorial service to finish that off, because obviously you had to get back to playing football on the pitch.
Yeah.
So after a while, they said, we'll draw a line and say this is the last one and we'll have a memorial. And I went along to, not particularly because it was the memorial service, but it was our turn basically to go and help anyone who came looking for assistance. But didn't need to, because, you know, Kenny and Marina were doing it all and doing a great job.
It's funny, people talk about like that impact and that connection that people have, and There's no need. There was never any need for him to do that. I say, you know, I mean, there wasn't. But
it's just just who they are. They're just great people. You know. Yeah. I'll tell you a story though. That was a bit of light relief. One of our staff. She loved John Barnes. She'd never been to a football match in her life, but she loved John Barnes. She fancied him like hell. And we were all sitting around in the players' lounge with nothing to do. And then we had to go to the memorial service. So she stood up, and John Barnes came over and picked her coat up and held it out for her to put her coat on. You know, she just melted. She never stopped talking about it. I was reminded of that because I met John Barnes the other day. Well, I say met him. I went over to him deliberately in the fan park and told him how brilliant it was watching him play football.
But yeah, I mean, and it's one of those things, isn't it? And I think. Obviously, Liverpool have had successes and what have you in the period that followed, and
thing for me about Hillsborough was I think that was the best side Liverpool ever had.
Yeah,
they were by far the best side in Europe, but never got to play in Europe, obviously because of Heysel, and then of course they have the Hillsborough tragedy, which basically finished that team off. You know. Yeah. It survived another year, basically, in the end. It took its toll on Kenny and the players, and they never really survived after that.
Yeah. There's a real sense I got when it comes round, like fast forward and now, like, you know, 25 years onwards, and you finally have the Hillsborough inquest and what have you. I think people don't understand at times how much that stigma hurt, not just the city, but everyone from the city and associated with the city and what have you, of like that was put out there by the Sun and by the Yorkshire Police and all that kind of stuff. Something you will have been more acutely aware of in the, you know, for the full breadth of that time. But you know, I remember moving to Sheffield and it being pubs, and you'd still get people say like, oh, because they told the truth, oh, and because you did this, you did X, Y, and Z. It's hard to put into words, really, isn't it? How much that a mismanagement leads to a situation that's hard.
You still get people calling us victims, and, you know, all that stuff, you know, and it's being shown clearly that we were not at fault, and it's been shown time and time again, and yet still ignorant supporters from other clubs are quite happy to throw up, you know, that we were, you know, culpable and responsible. I mean, it's just unfortunate that after Heysel, we were easy targets.
Yeah.
You know, and the people who wanted to get rid of blame from themselves saw us as an easy option. Yeah. You know. And the Sun willingly, you know, colluded with that.
Yeah, it's that real sense that when the Hillsborough inquest and the results were revealed, and we, you know, it was finally proven beyond all doubt that Liverpool fans were, you know, their exoneration from wrongdoing at Hillsborough. It's weird. It felt like a proper watershed moment for the city, and you know, it's obviously things are still ongoing as it stands, but I cried so much that day when that was finally, when even like, you know, I've got no love for David Cameron, but you've got David Cameron saying it in Parliament, and you've got all the things coming out. It shouldn't be underestimated just what an impact that has on the people of Liverpool.
I mean, even now, you still can't say a lot because the whole thing's still up in the air. But you carry that weight around with you, though you don't want to,
yeah,
because you are constantly reminded of it. And the burn and injustice of it was, you know, was horrible to have to live with.
Yeah.
And, you know, that makes it worse when other fans, you know, throw it back at you all the time.
That's the thing I think is disgusting. I see it from both sides. That's why I can't stand, like, I mean, I see Liverpool fans saying anything about Manchester United and Munich. I find it absolutely abhorrent, you know, and using grief and disaster as banter.
It's unforgivable, isn't it? Given our history, you know, it's unforgivable to try and use other people's tragedies as a weapon against them. It's just disgusting.
Yeah.
You're not a Liverpool supporter if you do that, basically. Yeah. And if you were caught saying or doing anything like that, I think you should be banned for life from Liverpool because you're not welcome.
Absolutely. And the thing that's been What I like is that what's happened with the inquest and moving on and moving past Hillsborough, we're starting to get to a situation where people can finally get on with their lives to some extent. And what I think's been great, and it's been such a weight that everyone's been carrying around. I mean, the football club's been carrying it as well to some extent, because they've had to shoulder it, because you know they've a sense of responsibility. Because if you know if there was no Liverpool fans could have died at Hillsborough. What I think what we're finally seeing now is a final. When I say a separation of the football and Hillsborough, I mean this in the best possible sense, because it'll never be forgotten. It's in the DNA of Liverpool Football Club now, but the fact that it doesn't need to be part of it, even going back to like the 13-14 for Liverpool, you know, chanting for the title. You had Margaret Aspinall saying like, "Go and win," you know, doing chants, shouting after saying, "Go and win the league," and all this kind of stuff. It's great that that's a thing that can now exist, you know, and continue to be supported aside from the football. But it does feel like we're finally able to get back to the business of being fans again and throwing ourselves into the game without having to have our focus divided by other.
I mean, as I say, it's still not finished. There's still work to be done. There's still court cases, you know, maybe appeals and stuff like that. But there'll come a moment when we can put it to rest. But you know, there were too many people who wanted it put to rest far, far too early.
Yeah,
you know, and
for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. And well, you know, I mean, in some cases, people I knew who were decent people, who were Liverpool supporters, who just got a bit fed up with the whole thing about Hillsborough and didn't understand, you know, and didn't really want to take the time to find out what had gone on. They just wanted to forget about it.
Well, when you get told stuff by the media and by authority, you know, by government and by police, these people who you're supposed to be able to take their word as gospel, there are just people who naturally do. take that word as gospel, don't they?
And the world is exactly like that now, isn't it? That there are people who are buying hook, line and sinker messages from the government that there's no poverty in this country.
Yeah.
You know, it's just ridiculous.
Well, bringing it back then, and in fact, I want to take it back to the start and some of the happy things. It's funny, whenever we talk about our experiences, we live in an era now where my son has basically the same things that I had, except they're just a bit newer and a bit more polished and a bit more whatever. You know, he plays the same computer, new versions of the same computer games I played, and he wears the same replica shirts that I wore, and he does all this kind of stuff. Your experience, the generational gap between you and me is so significant, I think, when I look at it at times. And it's whenever I hear you tell stories about going the game as a kid, it's something else, because we hear this like mythologized stories of the old boys' pen, and what have you.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't fathom a world. So for people who are maybe aren't Liverpool fans, or people who are of a different generation, it's effectively a cage to put children in in the top corner of the cop.
Yeah, it's like a cross between a concentration camp and a creche.
And the, you know, because you hear this, like there was a rite of passage for all boys going into there.
At some point, you had to climb out.
And what was that? What was that like?
That was terrifying. You're talking like 12-foot steel pikes and barbed wire. So you get on the other side, and you're like a ragamuffin torn to shreds.
Because was there a story about the first time you did it? And you were in like your Sunday best or something?
For some odd reason, I was in the best clothes that I possessed, yeah.
What happened there?
Well, they just got ripped to shreds, as I said. They were tattered, and I cried my eyes out all the way home because I thought my mother was going to kill me. And she just burst out laughing. Which was worse. I was thinking, though, I was just crossing my mind over the weekend that because I've had all these Liverpool songs just running through my head constantly, that you know, we sing songs about Kenny Dalglish and Stevie Highway, who were not most, but a lot of current supporters that never saw play.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking, 30 years since Kenny gave up playing, and 40 years probably since Stevie Highway gave it up. But when I was, say, your age, I wasn't singing songs about Albert Stubbins. It just didn't happen. You know, I mean, or Bob Paisley, you know, as a player, or even Billy Little, who was, you know, a god. You know, and we didn't sing songs about them.
What did you? Because I always find this funny, like. Because You Never Walk Alone came about because it was played. It was like in the charts, wasn't it? It was played before the game, and it took off from there. What did you sing? What did you do? Shook Rattles.
Well, when I started out, it was Rattle. I remember the first game I went to, the Sunderland game. The Sunderland fans sang, and I thought, oh, that's really weird, isn't it? You know, didn't. And Liverpool didn't really. They cheered and shouted, and then gradually, in the mid '60s, it was like a blooming. The whole city sort of bloomed with the music, and we had a great football team, and there was great wit in the Kop. It was such a funny place to be. There would be people who would just be throwing out remarks, which just had you in. Creased up, yeah. And they were turned into songs, and that stuff about Poor Soldier Tommy and all that kind of Post stuff. Tommy. Yeah, that all came out of that, but I don't even remember the point where it came. It just suddenly became. You'd sing like She Loves You, yeah. Those kind of things were almost once they came out as singles, they started to just be sung on the Kop and then turned with a little twist into a Liverpool song. And that just became something that you did.
It's funny, isn't it? Because the 60s, you think about it, you look back, it's probably the era I look back with most jealousy of is probably 60s Liverpool, when you've got the rise of the Beatles. It's hard to imagine. We did a video on it. The FA Cup final in 65, Liverpool lift the FA Cup finally, and is that moment where you think that's the melting pot in which modern Liverpool ends up being born?
Yeah, it's because we won the title twice and we won the FA Cup in between, sandwiched in between those two, and we had that great European adventure, and that's where that began. Getting to the semi-final and really being robbed of a semi-final, robbed of a final place, and Europe just became a mission almost, and we felt it like our birthright, that we were, it was a competition for us, because it meant something.
What did it mean then? Bring it back to the modern day. Then we got to go to the final. You'd never been to a European Cup final before.
No, and. I was thinking about it because, as you do, I became interested in football because of Real Madrid. There was a nine panel cartoon on the inside front page of the Pink Echo, it must have been 1960, because Real Madrid had just won their fifth European Cup, and there was this story, for a few weeks of Real Madrid, how they. Had an appeal in the city for money so they could build a stadium, and how they could bought a team, and then how they went on and won five times. And I was just mesmerised by this thing about Real Madrid and the European Cup. And it was then that I, asked my dad if I could go to the match, because I wouldn't have dreamed of sort of trying to go on my own, yeah. A couple of years later, or two or three years later, we were skipping the boys' pen and catching money from people to go into the ground. But too scared to go in the Kop, in case you were seen, so we used to go in the Anfield Road end. But Real Madrid, loomed large in my sort of desire to watch live football.
That's fascinating, really. So, where does it rank then? You've seen countless...
What, this European Cup final?
Yeah.
It's really difficult to say, because football's one of those things that excite you or depress you, you know, and you get, it's a roller coaster. I mean, I always remember, say, we were in the semi-final against Arsenal, and I think we drew about two or three times, and we kept going back to Villa every week, waiting, you know, for a result. And that was one of the first occasions ever that we got searched on the way into a ground. And when I got in, we were already a goal down, and we spent the whole game a goal down. And then in injury time, Kenny Dalglish scored an equaliser. And I'd never been so excited in my whole life. It was just incredible. And you can't get away from moments like that. And you can never say something tops it.
Yeah.
Because at that time, it was the greatest thing you'd ever experienced in your life. And it's etched into your being.
Yeah.
So, you know, the whole experience was better than everything's, because it was a whole experience. It wasn't just going the match and watching us beat Tottenham 2-0. It was that experience of being in a city where the streets were full of Scousers who were all full of smiles. And, you know, we talked to a lot of people as we walked around, didn't we? And the fan park experience, as you said, going down to a bar and meeting, you know, a dad and lad from Australia. You know, all that kind of stuff put together makes it just unbelievable.
Yeah,
incredible.
That's the thing for me. It's
why it's difficult when you come back and you hear people saying, "Well, it wasn't much of a game, was it?" Well, I never had to my head at the time that I was watching dross.
No,
I just thought I'm watching the European Cup final, and Liverpool are actually in control of this.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I said this for years. We've done the best final ever. 2005 is the best Champions League final ever. I don't care that it wasn't a great final for the neutrals. I care about the fact that I've seen Liverpool be brilliant and fall flat so many times. They've broken my heart so many times.
I think it actually was the perfect culmination of our season, because this season we stopped being the flamboyant team that conceded loads of goals and scored more than that.
Yeah.
We became the team that was solid, and we didn't concede goals, and we won games just by being pragmatic. And this was the perfect culmination. That's exactly how we played all season. And anyone who says to you that, "Oh, well, you know, Tottenham put us under the cosh," or whatever, and I've watched it back since, and at no time were we not in control of that game.
Yeah.
Even the saves made by Alisson, I think there's only one of them.
Probably Lucas Moura, is it? He has a good chance that he scuffs, doesn't he? Quite central.
Yeah, and he makes two or three saves, but only one of them when I think, wow, that's a brilliant, you know, save. I wouldn't have, maybe another goalie wouldn't have got that.
Yeah.
All the rest of them were routine saves that most goalies in the Premiership wouldn't save. So at no point, and these were like in the last 10 minutes,
yeah,
at no point did I think we were not in control of that game, because that's the way we played our football.
I've heard it said that it feels more, this feels like, and this is again, apologies for anyone who's not a Liverpool fan, and they'll have to live with us potentially with this for a few years, but it feels like more like 1977, Liverpool lift the first European Cup. This feels like the start of an era as opposed to being
I sort of felt that beforehand. Somehow, you know, Klopp is as close to Shankly as you'll get, you know, and more so than Paisley or whatever. You know, it feels to me more like the beginning of an era rather than just another blip in there, you know, as we've had since 1990.
Mm.
You know, and I'm still astonished that we didn't win the league.
Yeah, but the good thing about this is that it means that you can look at that league run and say, you can applaud it for the effort, as opposed to being some sort of trite, "Oh, well done, you did okay, you know, you great also runs," to then go and win.
Well, they always say, you know, if you finish 20 odd points off the league, it's going to take you maybe three seasons to get up there and win it, assuming you ever do. We jumped that gap in one season, and we've only got 1 point to make up next season, you know. So that to me, you know, means that we are now right at the top. And I'm fully expecting a major assault on the title next year.
Absolutely. We normally wrap these podcasts up with some life advice. I'm throwing this on you completely unprompted.
Don't do it.
Don't do life. in your 67 years, if there's one piece of advice that comes to you that you can hand down to someone in anything, from any aspect of your life whatsoever, that's going to save them some time, effort, heartbreak, or anything in between?
What would it be? Gosh, one piece of advice.
I mean, if you've got 10, by all means, feel free to deliver 10. But if there's one, it can be anything from the profound.
I want to advise people about anything. I mean, just do what you think will make you happy.
I don't think you can do much better than that. Dad, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. A more than adequate substitute for Mr. Chris Pajak, who will be back on the podcast next week. He's got a special guest lined up. I'm going to be taking a little bit of a break. Thank you very much for watching, for listening, and for subscribing to the YouTube channel. If you've got this on your podcast apps, whether it's on iTunes, Spotify, anything like that, a 5-star review. 5 stars can mean something different now. It just means great. Let's have a nostalgic 5 stars. The last time we get to do this, put our five fingers up.
We still won 5 in Istanbul. So
yeah,
that's still appropriate.
Of course. So yeah, leave reviews, leave comments, leave anything. If you want some life advice for next week and beyond, let it know in the comments below. Other than that, thank you very much. Thanks for subscribing. See you all soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.